You're listening to There Ought to Be a Law, the Center for Auto Safety podcast with Executive Director Michael Brooks, Chief Engineer Fred Perkins, and hosted by me, Anthony Simino. For over 50 years, the Center for Auto Safety has worked to make cars safer. Hey, everybody. Just got to let you know before we start, if you don't buy a Tesla, you are a terrorist. or you might be deported. Unlike our first guest, who won't be deported, welcome to the show, George Inney of the Automobile Protection Association of Canada, also soon to be known as the first 51st state of America. Welcome, George.
That's not a very auspicious introduction.
Well,
no. And,
thank you nonetheless.
Yes. Either
it's
way.
A pleasure to be on your podcast.
Well, we're glad to have you because we want to find out more about Canada. Because essentially what, I mean, stop me if I'm wrong here, but essentially the Automobile Protection Association is similar to the Center for Auto Safety, just with different bacon, right?
Yes. We're lucky because we benefit from the work that the center does and also the regulatory environment in the U.S. So we get most of the American standards without really having to fight hard for them. And the association, the APA, is more involved in also looking at the marketplace, the retailing standards for cars, car repairs. So because in a sense, you do the hard work on the standards and safety.
That's great. I want everyone to remind that we do the hard work, specifically
me and Fred. We do the other hard work. Take on the car retailing. We've been quite involved in and we sit on committees that regulate automobile retailing standards. For a long time, we were the Canadian equivalent of Consumer Reports. We did the vehicle testing program for the French language Consumer Reports publication. So that was part of our activity, and they still issue an annual car guide in April that is that we prepare the vehicle reviews for.
Very, very cool. So we've talked in the show about the differences in like fatality rates between the U.S. and Europe, and how speed in this country affects crashes and deaths and accidents compared to what they do in Europe. And we talk about Euro NCAP quite a bit in terms of different safety standards. Strangely enough, and we've never compared any of this to Canada, because as good Americans, we just assume whatever, right? But there's quite a bit of difference between the U.S. and Canada in the stats. Is that right, George?
Yes. Basically, if you're looking at Canada versus the U.S., the easy way is just divide by 10. So we're about a tenth the size of the market.
Okay.
And so, you know, our fatality rates are in the range of 2,000 a year. So that is, our fatalities are in the range of roughly 2,000 a year, actually a bit less, 1,800 a year. And so it's significantly lower than the United States. That wasn't the case when we started. If you're going back to when vehicle safety began to be regulated, Canada actually was worse as a percentage. What happened in 2008 with the real estate induced economic downturn, our rates went way down in that period. So if you look at the fatalities in 2008, 2007, 2,400 people, 2008, 2,100, 2009, 2,000. So it's a big drop. And it continued to drop after the economy began to improve. And that was really against current thinking. That's not how it usually works. Usually when there's an economic uptick, fatalities go up. Unfortunately, the last two or three years, for reasons that aren't fully understood, we're now seeing increases again. And like you, pedestrians and cyclists have the largest increases.
Okay. What's the, any insight into why there's been that steady drop? Because in the U.S., we really haven't had that. We had the bump during COVID where everyone decided to drive like a maniac. which caused things to go bad. Did Canada have that experience, or is there some different regulations in line, or just Canadians better drivers?
I don't think Canadians are better drivers.
Damn right.
And the interesting thing is people sometimes say, well, it's because your climate is different. But actually, our worst months for fatalities are July and August, when the climate is roughly the same. So my thinking has more to do with exposure and time on the road. There's maybe a couple of things. Canada early on didn't really have the muscle to take on the automakers over airbags. So all of the pressure for installation of airbags really came from the US. And we got the standards and we got the airbags because of the American work. But what that did do is leave a space around belt use and seat belts, wearing rates. Enforcement was higher. There were national programs. And it's currently around, I think, over 95%. So that's part of it. Speed enforcement. Most places in Canada, you can't really drive for sustained periods above 75 or 80 miles an hour without getting a pickup, a ticket. And I know there are states in the US as a visitor where you really could do that. And I'm thinking that might have some impact. I'm not sure if the size of the vehicle fleet is an issue as well, or the size of vehicles, that is. They're smaller in Canada, although we also are seeing a bulking up. But a mid-size, like what's considered a compact SUV, which has actually become a quite large and heavy vehicle, but something like a RAV4 or a Chevrolet Equinox is sort of the sweet spot in our market.
Okay. Michael, what's the seatbelt uptake in the US? If Georgia's saying it's 95% in
I
Canada.
want to say we're close to 90, so I think we're definitely a little lower, and that can explain a lot in terms of the data, because seatbelt use is so critical to preventing fatalities and injuries. So that may account for a large portion of it. I mean, it's interesting when you look at maps. George was mentioning the summer being one of the most dangerous months. When you map out the traffic fatality rate across the United States, what you see is a lot of poorly performing states in the south and southeast, up through a belt kind of that cuts through the Midwest and the upper northeast, and Washington state. Those areas that are near Canada seem to do a little better on the roads as far as traffic fatalities. At first, when I was looking at the data between the United States and Canada, you would think there would be slightly more dangerous driving conditions in Canada because of the more extreme winter weather that they have there. But looking at the United States on its own, the states that get some of the worst winter weather are actually in a lot, they have a lower fatality rate than a lot of the southern states that never or rarely get snow. So it's interesting to take a look at the data when it's mapped out like that.
Michael, as a Southern American, you must explain this difference to us.
Well, it's I mean, we know that the number one cause of crashes and some of the number one causes behind them is speeding, aggressive driving, typically by males. And I'm assuming that that simply, and a lack of seatbelt wearing and that sort of thing. I'm assuming that that kind of behavior takes place more often in the states that we see. Mississippi, Louisiana, New Mexico, I think, are some of the worst. I'm guessing there's, a lack of, significant enforcement in those states around seatbelt laws and speeding and aggressive driving and that sort of thing. And because of that lack of enforcement, like we saw in during COVID, the lack of enforcement, how that impacted traffic deaths, I think that plays a major role in this state by state fatality rates.
Could it be the mixed messaging that you get? I remember driving through Louisiana and it was very mixed messaging because one side of the road there's billboards for like repent now, come to church. And the other side were all ads for strip clubs
Sex
and sex
shops.
shops. So as a young driver, you just might be like, am I going to hell or am I going to the clinic? Like, and
It
you're
is truly odd. I notice that still every time
yeah.
I go down there.
And it's
On
maybe that's
freedom
why
of
people are speeding.
it,
Sorry, Fred.
it's on freedom. Hey, George, I got a serious question, actually.
Oh no.
Is it the licensing standards in Canada, are they the same across the entire country, or is it
go province by province, and I'm really looking for a comparison with what goes on in the US.
So there are 10 provinces. It is province by province. Most of them have some form of graduated licensing. But the skill required, the number of hours of training would be similar, I think, to what you have in the US. I don't, and certainly not like earning a driver's license in England or Ireland or Europe, where the hurdle is quite a bit higher.
Because each US state does its own thing too. Because having gotten licenses in three separate states, I'll tell you, getting a license in DC, just show up and shake someone's hand. There you go. Here's a driver's license.
Wow.
Well, that explains why people can't drive there. So the cars in Canada, you guys are using the exact same cars that we have in the US. It's not, you're not, you don't have any different models. You're not getting like something that it's only for sale in Europe or only for sale in Canada, right?
No, only for sale in Canada, but there are very occasionally a small vehicle that might not be sold in the US. Nissan did it with their littlest car, the Micra, called it's made in Mexico. They sold it in Canada and not in the States.
Okay.
But it's very much the exception. Where the difference occurs is in the mix, particularly in French Canada and in our Atlantic provinces, so the ones that are north of Maine. The vehicle fleet is made up of smaller vehicles than we have elsewhere in the country. As you go west into the prairies, you have a higher percentage of full-size pickups and larger vehicles.
Okay, because
Are you, excuse me, are you importing the lower priced Chinese electric vehicles now, or do you have the same kind of barriers we've got here?
mainly, I think, out of fear, and because the government has sort of invested heavily in future battery production, which may now be threatened, and also electric vehicle assembly. They introduced the tariff at the same time as the Americans. I personally thought it was a mistake. There are rules against dumping, and there are ways to deal with it. And maybe the tariff that should have been arrived at would have been one that would have been done after a proper economic analysis. When Hyundai came to Canada, they were selling vehicles. General Motors challenged them. The car they had at the time, called the Pony, General Motors said was too cheap. And there was an extensive study impact on the impact of it. And ultimately, they decided that I think Hyundai was dumping, but no one was selling a $6,000 car at the time. So they weren't actually taking away, the perception was, market share from an equivalent North American model. And I don't think they had to pay penalties. So I would have liked to see, because we have a very strong electric vehicle mandate, which here is not threatened. It probably will be around, or something close to what it is now. That's my guess. There should have been maybe a place to consider for that kind of production.
Well, you just had a change of leadership of the federal government. Is that change related, or going to drive any particular change in the automotive industry that you can see? Or is that policies pretty much carrying over from the previous administration?
So we actually, as of a day or two ago, are in a general election. So the government hasn't changed. What did happen is, it's a parliamentary system. So the leader of the guy of the party that's in charge has resigned. He's been replaced by someone else chosen by his party.
Right.
That's the Liberal Party, and they're running. We have a short election campaign, but it's just a few weeks long. And then we'll know which is the government in charge. So right now, you could call it a form of caretaker government.
Has Elon tried to join your government yet, like he did ours, or is he staying out of Canada for now?
Well, you can't say staying out of Canada as far as the US is concerned. I think they will have and it's because of the invitation to join the US. It's rather muscular. It's sort of caused a kind of an existential, I don't know what you would call it, but feeling in Canada. It's taken quite seriously, and I think will be a feature of the next election. The party in power now, the Liberal Party, was widely perceived as going to be taking a big fall in the next election, but actually, because of the, I guess we could call it, noise from the US, It's sort of given them new wind in their sails. So we'll have to see if, in fact, they may come back, perhaps on the argument being that they're perceived as a more centrist, less radical solution than our Conservative Party, which whose leadership is a little modeled on Donald Trump, on sort of doing a radical sort of reboot. And the events in the US right now have made it perhaps a little harder for that kind of message to be taken up.
So when a government changes in Canada, is it going to be the thing where the Canadian equivalent of NHTSA has an opportunity to be like, hey, let's throw everything out. Let's change all these rules like we're suffering with right now in the US?
Well, the leaders of our Road and Motor Vehicle Safety Directorate are not necessarily people from industry. They're career bureaucrats, managers. In the old days, I liked it because they actually were people from inside Transport Canada. So they were often engineers, people who had delivered papers at conferences and academics. It hasn't been that way in a while. I think the government perception is that if you're like a senior manager, you can learn anything and sort of manage. And we don't have the same level of, and I don't know if many other democracies do after an election, of just chopping all the heads at the top and bringing in other people. So it's less of a feature here. What you can have a difference is if your Minister of Transport is interested in road and motor vehicle safety, then you get a more active development of standards and regulations as well. That's better. I mean, I should say our standards, for the most part, are American standards that they're copied, and that's generally been a very good thing. We ride on your coattails. We get a free ride to some degree because of that.
Brett, if you were born in Canada, your life would be so different. You could have been in government overseeing safety for cars.
I don't fit well into government seats, I'm afraid. I tried that once. But
Well, you are
hey, just
quite
for your
tall.
information, I have hitchhiked all the way across Canada from Halifax to, is it Long Beach out on the west coast of Vancouver
Yes.
Island? Yeah.
Wow. That's
So,
more than you've seen more of it than I have, and I've seen a lot of it. Wow. Bravo. That's a long ride. That's what, 3,000 to 4,000 miles
a lot of
easily.
it's awfully flat, so you can just, if you've seen a pool table, you can skip over Manitoba and Saskatchewan.
That's right.
All right, back to serious things. So the question I was asking before is if you have different types of cars and whatnot compared to the US, because something we've talked about not for a while on the show, but we talked about repeatedly for a while was the Hyundai Kia cars being stolen in the US constantly. Kids were doing this because the cars lacked an immobilizer. And now when I met you a couple weeks ago, you're like, we didn't have that problem in Canada because we have free health care. You suck. You didn't say it like that. But apparently in Canada, it's the exact same car. It's not like a different vehicle, but Canada by law required an immobilizer. Is that right?
Yes, we've had I would say three or four epidemics of auto theft, one in the 90s, one in the early 2000s. We're going through one right now. And in the early 2000s, there was a perception that, in fact, vehicles had become very easy to steal. I sat on task forces at the time, and the police were telling us that certain Mazda models, you could pop the door lock with a popsicle stick.
Wow.
It was that easy. So the locks were really cheap, and the cars had become sort of a form of, I would say, a low-cost transportation for teens. So the perception was we need to make them a little harder to steal. The car industry pushed back very hard. There are two arguments they made. The first is if we can't have a unique standard for Canada, it's too small a market. It will make vehicles in Canada very expensive to produce. The second one is we don't steal cars. Thieves steal cars. And that's sort of a turning a blind eye to the societal cost of automobiles. That, by the way, is still the case with the car makers now in the current epidemic. So our government actually drafted an immobilizer standard, a very simple one that was developed by the insurance companies in 2007, and almost immediately joyriding went way down across the country. So it resolved it to the point that, the special police task forces that had been brought out to combat auto theft, the insurance industry working groups. I remember one of them, the chair of it, who was a very experienced person from the insurance industry. We had our last meeting roughly in 2008 or 2009. And he said, "Well, we'll see you all in 10 years." Because he knew that nobody would be watching the store. The standard at the time, everyone knew, was going to be good for about 10 years. So when the TikTok video came out, all of our cars, including Hyundais and Kias, had at least a rudimentary electronic theft protection. And so it didn't really play out in Canada in the same way. The big benefit from that, we are now trying to deal with auto theft yet again. It's a much more international business in Canada. Theft recovery rates are low. They're around 40% because it's really rings that are doing it. And vehicles are put in containers and sent to mainly to the port of Montreal to be exported or chopped into parts. And so our government is actually working on a new anti-theft standard, and the car makers have made the same arguments again. The cars will be too expensive, and we don't steal cars.
So, how much did the price of cars go up when this law was put into place in 2007?
I think it was estimated to cost about at the time between $10 and $15 a vehicle, and I've seen estimates later that were as low as $4 or $5 if you wanted just the basic rudimentary system. The other thing they didn't consider in those days was that the mechanical key was about to disappear. So you also lost one another line of defense. I mean, someone, it's now done electronically, right? As opposed to having to actually bust locks if you're sophisticated.
So, Michael, what's been the argument against legislating the requirements of immobilizers in the US?
Well, it was mainly a cost decision for NHTSA not to do it. Really, it's the industry came in and said, "We don't want to do this." And NHTSA said, "Okay. What you can do is either put an immobilizer on the car or label certain parts in your vehicle so if the car is stolen, we can kind of track where they're going." And so all the manufacturers, or Hyundai for sure, and Kia chose the parts labeling requirements. Some manufacturers did put immobilizer in the vehicles. That's why during this Hyundai Kia thing, it was mostly Hyundais and Kias getting stolen because every other manufacturer ultimately has put immobilizers in their vehicle by the time the TikTok hack started. So it
Well,
was a
what
bad
happened actually,
decision. Yeah.
what happened was a case of where the Canadian standard kind of got everyone to step up their game for North America,
Yeah.
which is nice. It was no one, at least not anyone I knew, thought that Hyundai and Kia had kind of finessed the system and had specced different anti-theft standards for the two markets. The other brands basically did it North America wide because it was cheap and probably the simpler solution.
Well, I don't get it. So it costs, let's say, on the high end, we'll say $15 per vehicle to do this.
Well, I think once you get rid of a mechanical key, probably less than that because it's electronic by then. When you started it, you were replacing a metal key with a metal key with a chip or no key. But I think once you're into push start, with a remote, I'm guessing that that's not the cost anymore.
But even still, so that's the consumer paying this, and if all cars just went up $10, $15, or $5, whatever it costs, is someone gonna be like, "Well, I'm not buying this car. I'm not buying a new car anymore. I'm not." That's $10 on a $20,000 vehicle. Like, was that their argument?
Oh
And they
yes, they said it will make us uncompetitive. They threatened actually. It was a,
uncompetitive to who?
well, I was in a meeting where they argued that they might have to close assembly plants because of if Canada's a hostile market. So,
Well,
well,
I mean,
if.
this is par for the course for the industry. I mean, they'll scream bloody murder over a $15 change. I mean, there's some changes like seat back strength, where it's been estimated that the cost to make seat backs better is between $2 and $5, and they're fighting it tooth and nail. So
And I
yeah.
believe that the genesis of that, am I correct that it's still the standard from the 1970s or 80s? This was that the seats were
Yeah.
flopping. Have been
Yep.
flopping for 40 years, right? I mean, most car makers presumably make the vehicles to a better standard, But yet there's still pushback from the industry to I think I'm right about that. I'm not
Yep.
sure if it's been changed, but I
That's
remember
it has not.
so the first debates around that were from the 80s. The standard, which was an industry standard, I think from the SAE, was already perceived 45 years ago as being inadequate.
Wow. Okay, so let's jump into my one of my favorite subjects, Tesla. From an article in Electrek titled "Tesla is banned from Canada EV rebate program, government freezes suspicious $43 million in rebate." Quoting from the article, Tesla has been banned from upcoming federal EV rebate programs in Canada as the government freezes this suspicious $43 million Tesla claimed days before the program was paused earlier this year. The move was suspicious as it would have required Tesla to deliver over 8,000 vehicles at just four locations on a weekend, which is physically impossible. So, why do you guys hate Tesla? Why do you hate our freedoms? Why? So what's going on? So is this EV rebate program, is this similar to what the US has, where if you got an EV, you get $7,500 or something like that and make Fred angry?
Well, that's correct. So there
Okay.
was a federal government after-tax rebate of $5,000, and it was budgeted up to a certain amount, and the government issued an advisory that it would possibly run out during this model year and would have to be renewed in a new budget. People did the math and figured there was a few weeks, maybe a couple of months left, and then suddenly, poof, it disappeared. And it turned out it's a, either Tesla were really way behind. In other words, they had failed to file for a bunch of cars they already delivered, like over months, or alternatively, this was a dazzling heist, like incredible. So it's one or the other. Actually filling out your claim as a car dealer is not fully automated. Most people have to, it actually takes time. So even just entering 8,000 claims would take time. So what we learned from that is that Tesla probably has some automated, like super software, to make those claims that other car dealers who are franchisees, they're not the car maker, they're making the claims themselves, don't have access to. And what ended up happening is on a Monday or a Tuesday, everybody woke up to see that the cars that they were about to deliver before this ran, the rebate ran out, suddenly no more rebate, including people who had already offered the rebate to their customers. So some dealers were left holding the bag because of it. You're not supposed to do that. I mean, theoretically, it has to be a car that's licensed and delivered to a retail customer. It can't be a car that you're holding inventory. Car dealers have a long history of what's called punching cars to qualify for automaker rebates. So if I'm afraid that if I don't meet my target, I'm going to lose my per vehicle bonus, then I'll put in someone from the administration department or my dealership or my cousin or my brother as a vehicle, and I'll register it as sold so that I can collect from Hyundai or Stellantis, I can collect my Jeep rebate of $4,000. What happens then, the warranty starts running from the date that you punch the car. So that's how we end up hearing about it, because the person who buys it eventually might not be given the full $4,000 rebate. The program's already ended, but the dealer took the money. So some cases, a car might be sold 3 or 4 months later.
Wait,
And
so
that can
wow.
create issues down the road. If you tell the customer and you say, listen, we got you a rebate that expired at the end of November, let's say a clearance rebate from the car maker. So you're paying a lower price, but bear in mind that your warranty started running from that day.
So
This is insane.
Tesla's proving yet again that it's really good at sniffing out government cheese, right?
Yes, or alternatively, they were really super late and rushed to apply for their rebates. But I'm guessing it's not the case, because the government has now frozen, apparently frozen it. I don't know if they can actually, how you reverse charge those things. I don't know how it resolve itself. The other surprise, though, in the announcement was that when the program is revived, Tesla won't qualify, even though it is an EV, and that's something that we there's no precedent for.
Why don't they qualify now?
I think it has to do with the tariff issue. It's
Ah,
a
okay.
form of selective retaliation. Canada has imposed tariffs on some imports from the US, but They've tried to focus on products that are made in Republican states, for example.
Got it.
So the idea is that we know, I mean, it's impossible. The US economy is 10 times our size, way more manufacturing than Canada has. So there's only a limited amount you could do by having sort of retaliatory tariffs.
Okay. Continue with the Tesla theme. All right, this applies to a number of companies, but really, let's focus on Tesla. How does Canada see Tesla autopilot, Tesla full self-driving, and things that that are clear lies that they say, hey, this car drives itself, this car makes roadways safer. In the US, it's kind of been like, okay. Is Canada, is there stricter requirements of companies that make these claims?
No, there are not stricter requirements. The requirements would be similar. We don't have a federal standard to cover full self-driving, and it's a complaints-based system where they look at crashes after the fact. Most of the activity around this initially was that it was like considered a brave new thing. So, if anything, Ontario, which is our province that does most vehicle all the vehicle assembly in Canada, it was considered really leading edge in your municipality if you had like a self-driving project with a university or with a car maker. It was, and so any sort of what you could call reawakening or hangover from that most likely will come from the US. Also, the risks for an automaker are much greater in the States because we don't have juries in civil cases, so you would never get the kind of awards after a fatality or a serious injury that you might get in the US.
You hear that, listeners? Maybe Canada is not the greatest place on earth. Okay. So reconsider moving there and instead take that money and go to autosafety.org and click on donate. How's that for a weird transition? Continuing with this, what's Canada's approach to, autonomous vehicles? Do you guys have Waymos running around? Any sort of robot taxis?
So not anywhere in near the level that you have in the States.
Because of snow.
Well, snow would be an issue, but I don't think that's a reason. I think the investments are being done by American companies closer to home, and the tests as well. There have been some in Ontario, and there were university programs as well. But my sense is that a university researcher is not going to be able to make the spend that private companies can do. So they were involved early on. There probably still are projects going on as well. But we're talking about onesies and twosies, not vehicles in commercial operation as cabs, as far as I know.
Is there anything equivalent to a nationwide Vision Zero in Canada? The US, of course, has done a very poor job of stepping up to systematic safety. But what is the complexion of that in Canada?
There is, first of all, some of the cities have adopted it. I don't think that any Canadian city was as successful with it as, say, Manhattan. But there have been, I say New York City. But there have been those same changes, around intersections, sidewalk design, restricting parking near intersections. And definitely, there have been national strategies both on drunk driving and on seatbelt use, for example. And they did deliver effective results. So they were called STEP programs, Selective Traffic Enforcement Priority, I believe.
Okay. I'm going to jump topics a little bit and let's focus on more of, I think, what the Automobile Protection Association does. Open recalls on used cars. So you said your organization works a lot with consumers dealing with dealers, right?
Yes, we look at the retailing environment for
Okay.
vehicles.
Do you guys work on used car dealers, I guess? Used car dealers. Yeah, there we
Sure.
go. Great.
Yeah, we were
So
absolutely.
how does that work in Canada with if there's an open recall on used cars? Do the dealers have to inform the consumer, or is it just kind of buyer beware, or does it vary from province to province?
It doesn't work at all.
Yeah, all right, just like
So
us.
the car dealer associations actually lobbied against requiring open recalls to be corrected on vehicles they offer for sale. They just think the whole concept of talking about a safety recall would spook a buyer.
I'm so sorry. This is insane.
Well, that's what they say. And the other issue is that insisting that a recall actually be corrected is a more involved thing than you might think, because in some cases the parts are not available. Take Stellantis, a Ram truck, you could be waiting a year for an emissions recall part to show up. There's plenty of other companies, Nissan, also terrible, 2 or 3 years for a hood latch repair part to show up. So the vehicle would then become unsellable. It would not only be a hardship on the dealer, but it would be a hardship on the customer who wants to trade it in, because no one would offer much for the vehicle. So what we end up doing, it's a kind of a collective amnesia. We'll be complain when there's 10 or 15 incidents around a safety failure on a particular model, and yet there could be hundreds or thousands of them driving around uncorrected for months or sometimes years, because recall completion rates are in the range of 80%. The other thing that hurts completion rates in Canada is the correction rate is required to be reported by the car maker to the government by law for 8 quarters.
That's
So the
it?
thinking, well, the thinking was you'd be done after 2 years. That's a long time. In the
Right.
1970s, that seemed, when those standards came out, those requirements, that seemed like a good long time. In fact, some car makers now take a year before they even supply the first recall part. So that's a problem. The second is they have argued that it's competitive information.
Wait,
It
that
should be hidden from customers because it might benefit their competitors. It's just nuts. It's totally self-serving, and the
That is
consequence
nuts.
is that the government is a bit hamstrung. They know which cars are not corrected because they get the data, but they're not allowed to publish it, publish a list. They will send Transport Canada sometimes send out an advisory for a particular brand of car model to say that you need to bring it in, but there you don't have on the, for example, on the recalls database where you look it up, they don't tell you what percentage of the cars are. Have been corrected, and that would be pretty easy to do.
That would be. No, NHTSA does it. It's in the recall
That's right.
system. And we only got, I think it was 5 quarters of information up to the year 2021 when the Infrastructure Act was passed. And I think that made it 8 quarters. So we're now on equal footing as Canada, but we can click in and see our reports and figure out where, the recall percentage is on each recall. However, I think our recall repair is coming in around 60%. So you're beating us there. It's really bad in the United States as far as the percentage of completed repairs.
Michael, do not admit failure in front of the Canadian. What are you doing?
Well,
My
it's amazing because many jurisdictions are able to collect unpaid parking tickets. I mean, they'll hold up your renewal,
right.
not renew the vehicle. So you could easily, if the provinces were more committed, recall law is federal, but there would be some way the two could interface so that when your license came up, maybe they'd give you a year or 6 months to take your car in, but you'd know before the next renewal
Yeah.
it's got to be clean.
So,
And in Germany, they come to your house and take the license plates off your car.
seriously?
Yeah. That's
Oh,
what my
that's
German
awesome.
intern told me. I mean, that is one side of the spectrum on how to make people get their open recalls repaired. However, I mean, that opens some questions when you have, for instance, the Nissan hood latch issue, or people are waiting 3 years for a repair. What does the government enforcement agency do then when it's clearly not a consumer's fault?
Wow. So, George, can I go to a new car dealership in Canada and purchase a vehicle that has an open recall on it that has not been fixed?
I don't think it happens. I mean, in that case, the manufacturer usually issues a stop sale order, and so it would be the automaker's decision. I don't know that the tra I mean, in theory, transportation. I mean, it's prohibited, but I don't know that the transport regulator has boots on the ground where they could actually check that and know of it. And certainly, the provincial registration system wouldn't flag it if you had a brand new car with an open recall. So it's really up to the car maker to issue it. And I haven't had heard complaints about it, about vehicles with stop sale orders being sold by dealers.
Because Michael, that is illegal in the US, correct?
Yes, you can't sell a new vehicle with an open recall, and you have to basically shut down sales of all those vehicles. That's one of the first things that manufacturer does when there's a recall issued. They don't immediately go running to their customers and tell them about it. That usually comes a few weeks later, but they alert their dealers to suspend all sales of those vehicles in their inventory until they can be fixed.
All right then. So I think, I mean, in the total score between the US and Canada, I think Canada's got the slight advantage there. I mean, US definitely got a point there for the end because it's definitely illegal.
Wait, wait,
Wait,
wait.
no, you don't think so?
What about something we haven't discussed yet, which might put Canada over the top clearly?
Is it pop?
Public auto insurance. What is
What is,
that?
wait, what is public auto? Because I just got my renewal for my auto insurance and every year it keeps going up and it's really expensive. Okay, do you guys have better auto insurance too?
We have different auto insurance again because
So
in the
polite.
public li the liability area, we there isn't a risk of those staggering, like very, very large awards. They can be significant, but anything in the single digit millions is very high in Canada.
Okay, so what is public auto like? How do I insure a car? Because like
So
in the US, there's all these private companies, and they're all like, hey, let's how far can we dig into your life to take every cent you have and then never pay out?
Right, so three and a half really of our provinces have a public auto insurance system. So if there are serious injuries, you're not suing the other guy's insurer or the other guy because you're both insured by the same person. So it cuts out cost. It's a bit faster in terms of getting your claim approved. In some cases, they look at if you're disabled or your life quality is diminished, instead of giving you a lump sum, you might get a monthly, like a stipend or an award. The perception being that may you're more likely to use it, I guess. It's
Right.
more likely you're more likely to be able to manage it, and it's cheaper in the system as well. So those are the benefits. I would say also the public auto insurers, unlike the US, we don't have an IIHS, for example. The public auto insurers are more serious about safety research, and because they're paying the bill, they're usually separate corporations, but they have the ear of the government. They're able to get involved in safety programs in a more sustained and systemic way, for example, than 100 private insurers through the insurance bureau. Which is the way that the private insurers work. Also, the provinces with public auto insurance have much fewer rate swings, and they don't have the same crises that we have with private insurance, where one year they're losing a ton of money and then another year they're making a bit of money. So it's managed a bit differently. I would say we have fewer complaints about insurance in those provinces, but they have detractors as well. And Quebec is interesting. It's a mixed system. So bodily injury is one insurer. It's a government insurer, and it's generally very respected. And collision looks like anywhere else. So the messy part, which is administering relations with body shops, estimates, appraisers, courtesy cars, is all handled by private insurance. And most of the time they make a decent return. So it actually turned out to be not bad for the private sector as well.
Wow. Well, do you have any idea of what the cost of insurance is? Say I live in Montreal. What would it cost to insure, let's say, a 2020 Toyota Corolla?
Well, you'd be part of it would be paid on your driver's license renewal and your vehicle registration, so there'd be a couple of hundred dollars there,
A couple
and
hundred, and that covers me for a
maybe.
year.
Yeah, but that's only part of it. And then about the collision and other parts would maybe be $800 to $1,000.
For a year.
In a private insurance, the next neighboring province, you'd be paying $1,600 or $1,700 for that car possibly,
For an entire
because
year.
because it's a private insurance province and it has a relatively inefficient insurance system that the insurance industry has repeatedly blocked from changing. What ends up happening when there are calls for public insurance, the insurance industry goes ballistic, the private insurers. And so they preserve the system as it is. In some cases, there are obviously caps on certain kinds of benefits. There are efforts to limit recourse to the courts a little bit, but it doesn't go to the core inefficiencies of the system. And I think the hybrid system in Quebec, where they kept collision, but the liability and injury side, sorry, the injury side was a single payer, has proven to give good results for both.
All right, I have to readjust the scores because Canada wins by
No,
far. No.
the only reason why we win, literally, our cars would probably look like vehicles from the 1960s. We win because all that development, all the push, the Ralph Naders and Clarence Ditlows, anything they did for you ended up benefiting us over the years at low cost.
That's yeah. So you win because my insurance is like for an entire year is like $3,400.
Yeah, so no, that would, unless you've had three Corollas stolen from your driveway
No.
and drove another one into a pole,
No.
you wouldn't be paying those rates
Yeah.
in most of Canada.
And you get free health care too in Canada?
Well, we pay for it,
Yeah,
but
but
yes.
Okay, how hard is it to learn the language?
Which one? You're
Canadian,
not
whatever
doing
you
too
guys speak
badly this
there.
morning.
Yeah,
Pardon?
all right. All right, with global warming, I think it's a winner.
Hey,
Yeah, Fred.
an unrelated question, I guess. Unlicensed drivers. So in the US, we have a problem where a lot of people migrate here with various degrees of documentation. And what happens is if they don't have proper documentation, they cannot get a driver's license, but they need the car to drive anyway. So there's a fair number of illegal drivers who are undocumented. And is there anything you can say about the comparison between the ability of unlicensed or new immigrants, or however you want to talk about people like that, in Canada versus the United States? This is, it's kind of a political issue here. People rail about unlicensed drivers, but they don't allow them to get the documentation that's required for them to get a driver's license, which makes no sense, but there it is. It's a political issue.
I believe it's probably a much smaller issue for us that we have a smaller percentage of unlicensed drivers per se on the road. I do know that the province of Quebec has recently tightened up its rules for new immigrants. What they discovered is that people from, for example, certain African countries with a driver's license just were not considered, they're not driving fast enough for our roads. So you might see them on the highway at like, driving at 45 or 50 miles an hour, sort of in the slow lane, presumably with white knuckles. And the what they've said is that, and these are driving schools who have pointed it out. They said people need a refresh, and so they're being required now to take a course, whereas before they wouldn't. But that's not unlicensed. Those are people who are licensed and who are here legitimately. But where the driver's license they earned is just not appropriate for the driving environment here.
How's that work, Fred?
It's a half answer. It's partly an evasion.
Yeah, I know that's what I was wondering
It's just less of an issue in Canada. As far as I know, unlicensed drivers are not as common. And perhaps partly because certainly we haven't had the probably level of migration that you've had of people who are undocumented, and probably the pathway to immigration here is a little different once you're already in the country. That's a guess.
Oh, thanks.
Once we cross the border, we'll start figuring out how to become citizens and lower our insurance rates. And then we can take all that extra money and go to autosafety.org and click on donate. Ooh, yeah. Time's flied. We're gonna jump into recalls. And I wanted to get into some things around Waymo, but I'll save Waymo for next week. So let's do some recalls. George, you want to stick around for our recalls? Great. So I'm convinced as a conspiracy gentleman, because okay, we recorded the show typically on Wednesday mornings, and invariably Wednesday afternoon or Thursday morning, There's some big auto news. There's some big recall. Last week, we talked about the Cybertruck, about how it's falling apart because they use the wrong kind of glue. And after we record, we post this, what happens? Cybertruck recall. That's right. What is it? Is this Cybertruck recall number 8, Michael?
This is the 8th time Cybertrucks have been recalled. However, to poke a little hole in your theory, I didn't check the NHTSA recalls on the Wednesday morning of last week. And so that Cybertruck recall was sitting there ready for me to notice, and I didn't see it. So that one's on me.
Oh, minus two, Michael, minus. Okay, so Tesla, 46,096 vehicles, the 2024 to 2025 Tesla Cybertruck. Like we said, they didn't glue it correctly. But remember, this was something that Elon said. It's going to be an exoskeleton. It's going to be so cool, man. It's going to be great. All the chicks are going to dig it. And it turns out none of this is true. It's just a normal car, and they glued on some stainless steel to it that magically rusts. And they're letting you know in May.
That's not going to be an over-the-air update. So owners are going to have a couple of months until they come up with a better glue and glue it back on for you. It looks like owners are going to hear more late May.
Yes. And if you've spent $100,000 and you're wondering, why can't they use Elmer's glue? Well, you know, you could have used that money to go to autosafety.org and donate, but you don't listen to the show. Next up, Nissan, 1,430 vehicles, the 2025 Infiniti QX60, the 2025 Nissan Pathfinder, the Nissan Murano. Due to a supplier production issue, their front brake caliper may have reduced strength and could break. Oh, that's not good. And you can get a warning of low brake fluid. Fred, how could a low, what is it? Why would I have a brake caliper? I thought a brake caliper was used just when they measure my brakes to see if there's still material there.
A brake caliper is the thing that squeezes the pads against the disc and makes your car slow down. So if the caliper breaks, it's not squeezing the discs, so your car isn't going to slow down. And because it doesn't have that resistance, it's going to, the piston's going to push way too far, which is going to absorb a lot more liquid, right, behind the piston. So that's going to cause your fluid to go down. So that's what's going on there.
Hey, this is the first recall I've seen where in the description of remedy, it says all repairs will be performed free of charge for parts and labors and may take 1 hour to complete. I mean, all recalls are free, but I've never seen them actually write that out and then say, well, it'll take 1 hour to complete. That's, you know, is that normal, Michael?
Well, I mean, this is Nissan. Keep in mind, they've got a couple of recalls out there where it's taken them 2 to 3 years to get the part available. So they want to make you feel like you're getting everything you can get as part of this, including a short repair time.
I think also the concern is that people are worried if they're going in for a sort of a brake job that they might be stuck with a bill. So maybe that's also part of why they've specified what's going to happen, and that if in fact your front brakes are worn out, you might be charged extra for new pads and rotors if it's needed when you bring the car in.
Because I know tomorrow I'm bringing my car in for new oil and for them to rotate the air in the tires, and that's going to take at least 2 hours. So maybe I'll get a Nissan instead. Next up, Chrysler, 3,919 vehicles, the 2024 to 2025 Jeep Wagoneer S. Just that one. Huh. If a headlamp aim is improperly adjusted, it may reduce forward visibility for the driver and create glare for oncoming vehicle drivers, which may cause a vehicle crash without prior warning. I agree. I think all headlights are designed just to blind me, and we should remove them all. No driving at night, no headlights anymore. I think I'm the only one.
Well, this is a weird one because it looks like they built, you know, almost 4,000 vehicles where the vertical headlamp aim adjustment. So you can adjust your headlamps side to side or vertically, and there is no mechanism or there is a mechanism, but it's completely inaccessible to anyone who wants to aim their headlights. So essentially, they built a headlight that can't be vertically modified. You know, if you go in for an inspection and they find out that your headlights are aiming too high or too low, you can't change it. So I believe they're going to have to go in and put a way for the headlights to be adjusted vertically into these vehicles or create some type of access to it, which seems like seems like a kind of a difficult recall to get done. So I'm interested to see how they accomplish it. There's not a lot of information on that.
All right. Well, that was our final recall. I didn't realize that. And with that, thank you for listening to another episode of Ask a Canadian. And thank you, George Innes, for joining us and letting us know all about Canada. You didn't explain to us how we can become citizens, but we'll figure that out for a future episode.
Yeah, I think that's outside of my bandwidth. But anyway,
you know.
Thank you. It was a delight. And I love your show. So very glad to be here.
Excellent. We're glad to have you.
Thank you, George.
Well, thank you, George. And thank you, listeners.
All right. Till next week. Maybe we'll talk about lightning next week. Bye.
For more information, visit www.autosafety.org.